So it might be a good idea, given that, to try and get some orientation of where we are. Let's try and track back and retell the story of the sutra. So remember, the Buddha is in travesty. He's staying in the Jeta Grove in the garden of Anathapindika. He's dwelling with a great gathering of monks and bodhisattvas. And early in the morning, he takes his bowl and goes to beg in travesty and returns, and having eaten, washes his feet and sits upright, mindful and aware. People are around, or people are gathering to take darshan, to listen to the teaching, to ask questions maybe. And after a while, the great disciple Subhuti comes along and joins the gathering. And then on bended knee with his hands in the Anjali Mudra, the Mudra of entreaty, he praises the Buddha for the great help and favour that he's given to the Bodhisattvas. And out of that expression of wonder and gratitude, he asks the question, the great question, the really important question: how should Bodhisattvas stand? How should they progress? How should they control their minds? And the Buddha's very pleased with Subhuti's praise. He says, yes, well said, sadhu, well done. You've said the right thing. I have helped people with the greatest help and the greatest favour, helped the Bodhisattvas, no false modesty. And this is a good question to ask. And then he speaks. He speaks about the Bodhisattvas developing bodhicitta, developing the desire to lead all possible forms of life to nirvana, and then realizing that no being at all has been led to nirvana. Then he moves on to the Bodhisattva's practice of generosity. He characterizes, you can characterize the whole of a Bodhisattva's life as a life of giving. But the Buddha points out that it's unsupported giving, giving without a notion of a sign, and this kind of giving produces a measureless heap of merit. Then the Buddha moves on to a discussion about the Buddha himself, the ideal man for a bodhisattva, the being he aspires to become. And the Buddha asks Subhuti, we enter into a dialogue now, whether the Buddha can be seen through his marks. And the Buddha concludes at the end of this short dialogue, the Tathagata is to be seen from no marks as marks. Subhuti is deeply impressed by the teaching, so becomes concerned that such a wonderful teaching should be understood in the future. Will it be understood in the future? He starts worrying, he starts to feel concerned that in those dark days, in the last 500 years of the time of the Dharma, beings might not, will they understand? And the Buddha's very strong, he's emphatic. There will be beings, bodhisattvas of good conduct, of wisdom, who will develop the one mind of serene faith on hearing the sutra, who will understand the sutra. These beings, these bodhisattvas, have planted roots of merit under hundreds of thousands of past Buddhas, and they are known they are, Subhuti, by the Tathagata. And why? Because they have no perception of a self, a being, a person, and so on. They have no perception of dharmas, of things, of processes that make up beings. They have forsaken dharmas and no dharmas. They've transcended all ways of categorizing and ordering and labeling experience. And then there's a further dialogue about the Buddha, about his knowledge. Does the Tathagata know enlightenment? Can it be known? Can it be taught? Can it be demonstrated? The answer is no. There's no dharma, no thing that knows enlightenment and that teaches and demonstrates enlightenment. And why? Because the uncompounded gives birth to, exalts, empowers, makes glorious the enlightened persons. So then there's a discussion of merit, the merit gained from teaching. Just a few stanzas of this teaching is immeasurable. It far outweighs the merit gained from elaborate worship of the Buddhas. And why? Because the Buddhas arise from this teaching. And the Buddha's special qualities arise from this teachings, but the Buddha's special qualities are not his own and special qualities. That's why they are his own and special qualities. So we're really in a rarefied sphere here, and it's as if the Buddha decides to kind of come down, as it were. So he comes down just a little way with a discussion of the stages of the path, a discussion of the four holy persons, the Arya Pudgala, the stream entrant, and so on. They are such because it doesn't occur to them that they have attained anything. Those who dwell in peace, the one who dwells in peace, that's the Arhat, Sabuti, does not dwell anywhere. That is why he is called a dweller in peace. The implication here is that all the steps and stages are essentially the same, that is, empty. And this applies even to the beginning of the path itself, the Bodhisattva's initial encounter with the Buddha, and the arising of his inspiration to follow the path of the Bodhisattva. So the Buddha says nothing, no thing, no dharma was transmitted between Dipankara and Sumedha, Sumedha being the Buddha when he was the Bodhisattva setting out on his career. Even the Bodhisattva's creation and harmonizing of Buddha fields, even his creation of worlds of harmony which are conducive to perfectly conducive for spiritual practice, is a no creation, a non-harmonizing. That's why there is creation and harmonizing. To sum up, the Buddha announces that the Bodhisattva must generate, produce, give birth to an unsupported mind, a mind without base, a mind without center, a mind without any definition or limits. And then he evokes the image of a vast body, a vast personal existence, as if trying to give some image of unsupported consciousness. But though vast, such a body, such a personal existence, a vast personal existence, is a no personal existence. So then, of course, it's obvious from such extraordinary teaching that the merit gained from illuminating such a teaching, explaining such a teaching, will be greater than all other merit. And the place, the spot where this teaching is taught will be blessed. It will be sacred. It will vibrate with the presence of the Buddha. Sabuti then asks the Buddha, what should the sutra be called? And the Buddha simply says, Prajna Paramita, the perfection of wisdom, or as Konza translates it here, the wisdom which has gone beyond. And Konza describes this as the first ending of the sutra, and it's what we've covered, though we have dipped into some of the sections in what follows. Konza describes this as the first ending because of the apparent chaos of what follows. Red Pine feels that, and also because it's at this point that Sabuti asks what the teaching is called. So Konza thinks this is a sort of end point. Red Pine is an American man who's done very good work on translating the Diamond Sutra and supplying various commentaries. He feels that Sabuti asks why this teaching is so called, because he's getting a real feeling for the teaching. It's going in. And he wants to know what it's called so that he can take things even further. And the Buddha does take things even further. And in the second half of the sutra, the Buddha takes up themes explored before. But they're all kind of mixed up with one another. And they come thick and fast. And indeed, new vistas are opened up. And if you open up to it all, if you spend time in this part of the sutra, and we're doing that with our readings in the evening, you can feel the mind, as Bhante says, being stretched to its limits. And we'd need at least another 2 weeks, another 2 years, another 20 years, another 200 years, 2,000 years, 200,000 years, 200,000 kalpas at least, to take, to even get into the Diamond Sutra a little bit. And there's no time for that.